Chapter 5. As the choppers hovered above the landing zone, LZ, the tremendous backblast of wind from the horizontal blades sent those items, not secured, sailing through the air. Several soldiers were waiting nearby, each faced in the opposite direction, covering his eyes for protection against the flying debris. When the three choppers finally touched down, the rotors continued turning at a high RPM. One of the nearby soldiers ran toward the lead helicopter with the new arrivals, the rest converging upon the other two supply-filled helicopters.
"Okay, Cherries, it's safe to get off,"
yelled the lone soldier.
"Put your shit over there by the first hooch inside the gate,"
he instructed, pointing to a dilapidated square block of boxes and sandbags.
"Then give us a hand unloading these two resupply ships,"
he added before rushing back to the next bird in line. A single long line of soldiers led away from each of the two helicopters. Crates and bags moved quickly along the human conveyor belt, passing from one pair of hands to another. After placing their gear near the hooch, the Cherries split up and joined their host at the end of each line, which by then extended through the gate 20 feet. In 5 minutes, both birds were unloaded and the contents stacked into piles almost 200 feet away. When the two lines of soldiers dissolved and moved away, the RPM on the choppers increased significantly. In turn, each of them lifted a couple of feet from the ground and then launched into the cloudless blue sky. In less than a minute, the windstorm and loud whooping noises were gone. Bill and John bumped into one another en route to retrieve their equipment.
"Bill, that was tough as hell. I tried everything humanly possible to keep up and not drop anything. In my line, somebody did drop a box, but the line never stopped, and stuff continued coming as if nothing happened. The guy wiped himself off and jumped back in without missing a beat."
"I never did anything like that before," John admitted.
"Things were moving so fast that when I turned back around, the guy in front of me was already dropping his package. I caught a lot of them in midair."
The other six Cherries rejoined Bill and John near their stored equipment.
"I think those other guys are trying to size us up,"
one in the group stated. They all glanced at the group from the firebase and found them to be watching the Cherries, commenting among themselves. There was pointing, snickering, and some giving each other a high five. There was a distinct difference between the two groups. The Cherries, dressed in brand new fatigues with creases, looked particularly out of place. Their shirt sleeves were neatly rolled up above the elbow, all but the uppermost button secured, tops of T-shirts peeking through from underneath. Hair was short, faces cleanly shaven, and the green canvas sides and black leather boots sparkled in the glaring sun. The other group, however, was just the opposite and offered the Cherries a preview of how they would soon look. Shaggy-haired and browned from the sun, many were shirtless. Their uniforms were severely wrinkled, bleached by the sun and 1,000 laundry washes. Some sleeves were cut off, and all fatigues appeared 2 sizes larger than needed. None wore belts. Their boots were muddy brown and yellow, some not even laced. 3 black soldiers stood out from the firebase crowd, each adorned with jewelry fashioned from black shoelaces. Braided necklaces hung from their necks, with 4-inch-wide bracelets covering their wrists. One of the soldiers had a braided cross hanging from his necklace. This form of braiding was the same taught in arts and crafts at summer youth camps. The square and round versions were always popular when making lanyards or whips with the thin, flat, different colored lengths of vinyl strips. In this case, shoelaces offered a much thicker and larger version. This jewelry made a statement, signifying the Black Power movement, and many of the black enlisted men in the country wore them. Suddenly, 2 Black Cherry soldiers left their group and rushed over to greet the other 3. They began a ritual handshake referred to as dap. Hands moved up and down each other's arms. Shoulders touched. Fingers snapped. Chests beaten. Palms slapped. Fists bounced. Finally ending in a traditional handshake. The last step in this process was for them to take their free hand and encapsulate the clenched hands. The greeting alone between the 5 of them lasted 2 full minutes. One Cherry remarked to the others,
"Ain't this a bitch? I bet after all that they still don't know each other's names."
The group chuckled and some began to give each other high fives. A black soldier, the shortest and possibly the youngest, left his group and approached the Cherries. He was lighter skinned than the rest, and he flashed deep dimples when he smiled.
a distraction from his curiously missing earlobes. He walked with a slight limp, trying to support his weight on the stronger left foot.
"Are any you Jerrys from Detroit?"
he asked, looking over the group.
John said excitedly,
"Yeah, I am,"
and raised his right hand in acknowledgement.
"Where in Detroit are you from, Chuck?"
he asked. John stopped in his tracks, scrunching his face in disgust. He shook his head from side to side and replied,
"Well, first of all, my name's not Chuck. You can call me either John or by my nickname, Pollock. It's your choice. And yes, I'm from Detroit and live in the Harper Van Dyke area."
The short black man began to laugh, briefly grabbing his crotch and then turned to smirk at his friends.
"Don't you know that over here in Nam, all you pretty white boys are called Chuck?"
he asked in a sing-song manner.
"You've been born again, and you should start getting used to your new name."
"Oh, fuck off,"
John responded. "I don't believe in all that extreme black power shit. Some of you people think you own the fucking world. I got lots of black friends back home, and none of them give me any shit like you're trying to do."
John backed up a few paces so he could see both the smaller soldier and the four other black soldiers nearby. He did not want any trouble, but if something were to start, he would be ready. Looking the short soldier straight in the eye, John said,
"Why don't you just go back to your bloods and practice up on your dap? You may be good at it someday, or better yet, maybe I could teach you."
Immediately, the black soldiers in the other group started to howl and laugh. They gave each other high fives and began swaying, leaning into each other as if they were all going to fall over. Then their catcalls began.
"Hooey, I know I heard that. Damn, blood, I guess he told you."
"Look here, we have us a white brother in the group."
The smaller soldier frowned and lowered his shaking head, not even sure that he had heard John correctly. Nevertheless, he had been embarrassed in front of his peers.
"Hey, brother man, all white boys from Detroit like you?"
one of the black soldiers with a small pick sticking out of his afro hairstyle asked.
"I don't know exactly what you mean, but in my neighborhood in Detroit, we all try to get along with each other. Besides, aren't all of us here on the same side?"
"Yeah, man, don't sweat it. It don't mean nothing. We're just fucking with you."
The short soldier raised his head and looked at John.
"That was a good one, man. I didn't expect to come back from you. What platoon you in?"
"I'm in the first platoon."
"Oh, cool. Good for you,"
he said and walked over to rejoin his group. After a few minutes, the veteran group merged with the Cherries, questioning them about news updates, hometowns, platoon assignments, football teams, and that free love they heard so much about from back home. The chatter gained momentum and became more intense as the one large group split into several smaller discussion groups. The soldier who earlier challenged John approached him slowly. He stood about 4 inches shorter and leaned into his ear.
"Hey, man, relax," he whispered. "My name is Junior Brown. My folks live near 6 Mile Van Dyke, which isn't too far from where you live, right?"
Caught off guard, John did not answer him immediately. Instead, he continued to stare at the young man, unsure of what may come next. Suddenly, Junior took him by the arm and gently led him away from the groups to an area behind one of the mobile water tanks, water buffaloes.
"Look here, John, I'm sorry about that Chuck shit earlier. I'm real not like the rest of the brothers, but it's a image thing, and it's something I have to do when not in the bush."
"What image?" John asked suspiciously.
"Well, you know, the brothers have been preaching that we're a minority over here, and we need to stand together to protect ourselves. Ever since the riots in Detroit and Newark a couple of years ago, they say it looks bad for a black man to be friendly with a white guy."
Junior shuffled his feet and shoved his hands into his pants pockets. Both glanced over to the mixed groups to see everyone talking to each other and being very cordial.
"That's a bunch of shit, Junior. If that were true, then why are you here talking to me? And why are the other brothers now acting friendly with everyone else over there?" "Oh, it's a family thing," Junior began. "See, as it turned out, all of us are in Alpha Company. The firebase supports the entire battalion. Guys are here from every company, and families gotta stay together."
"Aren't we all one big happy family here?"
"Yeah, in a way we really are. Consider your fellow platoon members as brothers. And then those from other platoons are your cousins. As a company, we're one happy family. The other companies are like neighbors. You'll help melt and all, but you really don't want to get into their business. We watch over our own, regardless of color, both in the bush and here on the firebase.
We have to depend on one another and watch each other's back. We can't let an issue like race fuck that up. By the way, I'm also in the first platoon.
So you're telling me that we're brothers now?
Yeah, isn't it a bitch? But I will tell you, my brother, that you blew me away when you mentioned where you lived. In my 4 months in the NOM, every time I met someone who said they was from Detroit, they actually lived in Battle Creek, Port Huron, or Flint. When I heard that you said that you were from Detroit, I thought, oh no, here we go again. Then when it finally hit me that we really were almost neighbors, that shook me up.
We're actually 3 miles apart from each other. But even so, I never met anyone in the service that lived so close to me.
Why don't you go and get your gear, and I'll show you around and help you get squared away. Then we can rap a little bit about home.
Okay, but give me a few minutes first. I want to talk to my friend and let him know what's going on. He's in the 3rd platoon, so I guess he's our cousin. Both laughed. John walked over to where Bill and the others were listening to one of the brothers speak. When he was within earshot, Bill turned and acknowledged him.
Damn, Polak, I thought you and that colored guy's gonna mix it up,
Bill drawled.
I did keep my eye on you just in case something developed.
Well, thanks, Bill. For a while, I thought it was going to come to that, too. As it turns out, he's not a bad guy, and I learned that he's almost a neighbor of mine back home. He's also in the 1st platoon, and he's going to help me get squared away.
Well, I'll be, Bill said, somewhat surprised.
You do know that you're the only one out of this bunch not assigned to the 3rd platoon. You see this guy here? Bill nodded his head toward the person talking to the group. He's from the 3rd platoon, too, and told us that half of their men were lost last week. How'd they lose half a platoon?
Morris, that's the guy's name,
said 10 of them finished their tours and went home. 4 others was hurt by a booby trap.
Did they get hurt bad?
He said nobody died, but assured us that they won't be back anytime soon.
Shit, booby traps, oh my God.
Both thought back to the final class of in-country training a few days ago. Bill, John said after regaining his composure, I'd better get going. I'll look you up later if I get a chance.
Take care of yourself, buddy,
Bill said. They clenched hands, not in a conventional handshake, but in a gesture of youthful brotherhood, chest high with palms together and thumbs intertwined. They pulled themselves together and warmly slapped each other on the back. John gathered his gear and returned to where Junior waited. Together, they headed for one of the hooches.
Hey, you and that other guy seem to be really tight, Junior said. Have you known each other very long?
We met on our first day in the service. We went through basic and AIT together, and then met up again in Oakland. His name's Bill.
That's pretty cool. And now you both lucked out and got into the same company over here.
Junior held an open makeshift door of the hooch and followed John inside.
This is some weird shit, John stated, looking around. I've never seen anything quite like this before. It sure beats sleeping under the stars. You'll do enough of that out in the bush.
This hooch was as big as an average-sized bedroom in the modest wood-framed bungalows of John's neighborhood back home. It was constructed from wooden artillery shell crates, each measuring 2 feet long by 1 foot high by 2 feet deep, which were filled with dirt and sand and stacked atop one another, forming the walls of a room that was 12 feet across by 7 feet in height. A picture collection, mainly comprised of Playboy centerfolds in simple wooden frames and protected by clear plastic covering, hung on the walls. This display reflected the efforts of a seasoned soldier who may have already gone home. The newest picture was over a year old. The ceiling had a base of flat steel plating that traversed the walls and supported 6 layers of green sandbags. Several 4-inch thick wooden beams, spaced evenly throughout the hooch, supported the heavy roof. 100 bulb string of holiday tree lights hung overhead and provided the only source of light. The cool dampness of the hooch was a relief from the stifling, muggy heat outside. The air was still and without circulation, but the sweet smell of burning incense emanating from a corner covered the predominantly musty odor throughout.
Junior, just how strong is this thing?
John asked, glancing around the shelter.
I don't know. Never seen one destroyed. I have heard that it will take a direct hit from a mortar and stop bullets, but those 122-millimeter rockets and RPGs wreak havoc with the bunkers and hooches. I wouldn't want to be in here then.
Does this place ever get hit?
Yeah, it did. Twice. At the beginning of last month. Normally there's only an infantry platoon providing security for the firebase artillery unit. On that particular day, though, an entire company of soldiers spent the night in the firebase, making it really overcrowded. During the night, the VC put sappers in the wire. One was careless and hit a trip flare, and it immediately lit up the whole damned area.
John listened, captivated, while Junior continued to relay the details of the assault, fascinated by Junior's knack for storytelling.
Bunker guards began a mad minute, shooting at shadows all around the perimeter. The rest of the company joined in the fire after reaching the surrounding berm, and now people have told me that the sight and sound of all that firepower, it was awesome.
Only one mishap occurred when several claymores went off at the same time. The explosions created a powerful, bright light that temporarily blinded the men on that side of the perimeter. Even with their eyes closed, the outline of the explosions remained and continued to affect their vision for a solid 15 minutes. They said it's like staring at a bright light bulb for 30 seconds and then closing your eyes, the glow remaining for a long time. Hundreds of tracer rounds fired during the attack added to the whole fireworks display. There were strings of moving red lights that flew across the ground and ricocheted into the sky after hitting the ground. And next morning, patrols discovered 6 VC bodies in the wire and several blood trails leading away from the firebase. Then, 2 nights later, after the company had returned to the bush, the firebase was hit with 20 mortar rounds. But only a couple of our guys got hurt, and there wasn't much damage.
Where's the company now? John asked at the end of Junior's account.
They're in a place called the Hobo Woods, finding VC and booby traps all over the place. In the 2 weeks they've been there, they killed 12 of the enemy and found a couple of caches, but we lost a bunch of guys too. Some might be back in a week or so.
When do you think I'll be going out?
They just resupplied this morning, so you missed your chance. You'll most likely go out on the next one in a couple of days.
Will you be going out too?
Nah, not for a while. I caught some shrapnel in my leg last month.
Junior lifted his pant leg to show John 2 raw and scabbed cuts on his calf.
I'm still restricted to light duty and pull bunker guard each night until I can walk without pain.
Wow, how did that happen, Junior?
We were mortared during one of our resupplies.
Were you really scared when you got hit?
Scare me? Hell yes, it scared me. Brother, I thought the bottom of my leg had been blown off.
Junior hesitated for a moment as he replayed the incident in his mind.
I was happier than shit when I found out there's only 2 pieces of shrapnel, but they went deep into the muscle. I had to learn how to walk again. Still hurts like hell.
There was an awkward silence for a moment. John cleared his throat and started to ask another question before Junior cut him off.
I know you have a lot of questions. I did too when I first got here. But save them for later, okay?
John bit his lip, took a deep breath, and conceded to Junior with an affirmative shake of the head.
We should go and see the executive officer,
the XO.
He want to meet you and know that you're here.
Junior led the way out of the hooch. The sudden brightness stopped John in his tracks. Shielding his eyes, he stood there for a moment in the doorway until his eyes adjusted.
That's why you got to get some shades like me, Junior quipped. Not only do they make you look good, but they help at times like this.
Both men smiled and began moving again. Junior reached into his pocket and pulled out some dirty and crumpled military bills.
Come on, John. I'll buy you a cold pop.
You know, that's really funny. This is the first time I've heard somebody call soft drinks pop since joining the Army. It's been soda from day one, and people look at me like I'm crazy if I ask for a pop.
I know the feeling. I still call it pop, too.
The young men were suddenly aware that it was good to hear their hometown lingo across the world from Detroit. They came upon a tent filled with cases of soda and beer. Just inside the entrance, cans of soda filled a 55-gallon barrel to the brim, smothering them in quickly melting ice.
Better get them now while they're cold,
said the soldier who managed the store.
He got that right, Junior agreed. Enjoy it while you can. There's nothing cold to drink in the bush. Everything will be either piss warm or hot.
Junior paid for the 2 drinks. John quickly opened his can and took several long swallows.
Phew, this hits the spot,
John proclaimed, then wiping his mouth with an arm sleeve.
Not bad for a dime, right?
Said Junior.
After you've been in the bush for a month, you'll gladly pay $10 for ice cold pop.
They finished the drinks and threw the empties into a nearby trash barrel. Junior led the way to a larger bunker in the middle of the compound. It was the main communications bunker, where battalion personnel constantly monitored activity in the field. They walked down several steps and entered a room.
One of the walls had several maps pieced together into one large map, representing the battalion's current area of operations. A small red X marked the individual locations of each unit in the field. At least 30 of them were scattered across a single area of the map. Several PRC-25 radios lined another wall. A lone soldier, looking bored, sat idly on a stool and waited for one of them to come to life. He would not have long to wait. It was already late in the day, and soon the patrols would begin calling in their night defensive locations. Once deciphered, the soldier could update the map with his grease pencil.
"Hey, LT!" Junior called out. "We have us new Cherry in the first platoon. Do you have time to meet him before I help him get squared away?"
"Just a second, Junior,"
a first lieutenant mumbled from behind a handful of reports. His face, disfigured slightly on the right side, looked like he had experienced a fire during childhood.
"I'll be right there."
The XO stood about 6 feet tall and could not have weighed more than 150 pounds. His custom-tailored uniform was starched with neat creases that could probably have cut paper. Even his boots were spit-shined and gleaming. Until a few weeks ago, he had been the first platoon's leader and had humped the bush with them for 9 months, 3 months longer than normal field duty for an officer. The colonel had to force him out of the field to serve as the XO for the company. He only had 6 weeks remaining in country before heading home. His job at the firebase was to liaison between the grunts, the infantry, in the field, and the rear, making sure the troops received everything they needed. Another part of his duty was to write letters to the families of soldiers killed in the company. He walked over to John and extended his hand.
"Hi, I'm Lieutenant Dobry. Kowalski, isn't it?"
John took his hand and shook it warmly.
"Yes, sir,"
the Cherry responded.
"Welcome to Firebase Keene. While here, be sure to pick Junior's brain and gather all the information you can from him. He's been in Vietnam a while and knows many of the tricks used in the bush."
Junior smiled upon receiving this recognition.
"Tonight, to get your feet wet, so to speak, I want you to accompany Junior on bunker guard. This will give you an opportunity to learn a few things and get your eyes accustomed to working in the dark of night."
"Great! At least I have some company for a change,"
Junior exclaimed. The LT continued.
"Then tomorrow afternoon, you'll accompany a team going on road security. Trucks will transport you about 6 kilometers, up the road to a knoll overlooking the main highway to Saigon. The team provides security for the passing convoys. They have been going to the same place for the last 2 weeks, and nothing has happened thus far. So you might actually enjoy the experience. Your team leader will brief you before leaving, right after lunch."
"When will I be going out to the field?" John asked.
"The day after tomorrow, when the company receives their next resupply."
After a brief moment of silence, Lieutenant Dobry asked,
"Do you have any more questions for me?"
"No, sir, I don't. But if I think of any, I'm certain Junior will be nearby to answer them."
"That's good enough for me. Junior, would you take John over to supply and help him draw out the rest of the equipment he'll need for the bush?"
"No sweat, LT."
And be sure to give him a hand packing his ruck,"
the LT added.
"Shit, sir, is already on my list of things to do."
The lieutenant looked at his watch and noted,
"It's almost dinner time. You two should head out and grab a quick bite first. Remember, you've only got a little more than an hour before you have to report to your bunker."
"Yeah, can't work on an empty stomach,"
Junior agreed, patting his stomach.
"I'll see you two later, then. Have a good night."
"Catch you later, LT,"
Junior responded. John waved and nodded his head slightly in response. "Junior, the LT appears to be a real decent officer."
"That he is, and he doesn't act like the other lifers here. You'll find all the officers in the bush to be like him. You'll see what I mean when you get out there."
After dinner, they headed to supply and drew out the items that John would need for the field. It took the two of them to carry everything back to the hooch. Only 15 minutes remained before they had to report for the night guard duty.
"We need to get your stuff together for tonight and head on out. It's almost that time,"
Junior said, noting the time on his watch.
"What do I need?"
"Just take your air mattress, poncho liner, a web belt, your 16, and throw the rest of your stuff on the cot."
With those items in hand, they left the hooch 2 minutes later. The perimeter is actually a 4-foot-high earthen berm, created by a bulldozer when constructing the firebase. It circled the many hooches, tents, and smaller bunkers of the compound. 12 standard-sized bunkers, 8 feet cubed, were evenly spaced on the perimeter. Supplementary fire positions, nothing more than semicircular metal culverts covered with sandbags, stood in between each bunker. To their front, rows of spiral barbed wire extended outward for 50 feet. Single strands of wire, pulled taut at ankle length, were interspersed with the other coils. Trip flares,
hanging metal cans with stones, and claymore mines completed the defensive perimeter. Hundreds of detonation wires snaked along the ground through the sharp barbed wire, connecting the claymore mines to triggered devices within each bunker. A green rectangular box with a telephone receiver cradled on top was also standard equipment within each bunker. A wire attached to the landline phone connected each bunker to the command post, CP. During the night, they would contact each bunker periodically to ask for a situation report, a SITREP. In turn, anyone on the perimeter could use the same phones to connect to the CP for special needs or requests of illumination after seeing or hearing movement within the wire. Mortar crews were on alert all night, as it was usually the busiest time of their watch. Junior showed John another standard piece of equipment, the Starlight Scope. It looked like a telescope, 3 inches in diameter and 12 inches long. An infrared light source within enabled the viewer to see in the dark, although everything appeared in a green hue. Their bunker was number 5. Junior walked to the small opening in the front of the bunker and pointed out to the wire.
The claymores within our area of responsibility are spread out across our front and all points forward, he said,
redirecting John's attention to several devices lying in a row across a sandbag shelf under the firing ports.
These are the detonators for each mine. You'll notice that only the center ones are pointing straight ahead, and those on either end are pointing in slight angles to either the right or the left.
Junior indicated to them to ensure John understood the difference.
These detonators point toward the mine facing in that direction. So if you see something in the wire, pick up the right one, remove the safety, and squeeze it.
John lifted one of them for a closer examination.
Now, as you can see, Junior continued, the clackers are similar in design to the V-shaped exercise grips a person might use to strengthen his hands and wrists, except these offer very little resistance, and only a small amount of pressure will collapse the handle. We usually squeeze those 2 or 3 times in quick succession until the mine blows. This is your first night out here, so don't panic. Stop blowing up the whole place just cause you hear something. Wake me if you get spooked. And above all, don't fall asleep during your watch.
John consented with a nod and then looked out into the wire, trying to familiarize himself with the scenery to his front, making a mental picture of everything he saw. Of course, it would all look totally different to him when it was pitch black outside. Meanwhile, Junior cranked the handle on the landline, waited a few seconds, then spoke into the mouthpiece.
This is number 5, manned and secured for the night.
After Junior returned the handset, he looked over to John.
Oh, another thing I forgot to tell you is not to smoke or light a match in the open. If you must have a smoke, then you have to cover up and light it like this.
Junior placed a cigarette in his mouth, then covered himself with the poncho liner. When he emerged, the lit cigarette was invisible in his cupped hands.
That's how you do it, he continued. To smoke it, cup your hands over it with the filter sticking out between your thumbs, like this.
The flaming portion of the cigarette was invisible in Junior's cupped hands. Only the butt stuck out.
You have to bend over low to the ground to take a drag. You'd be surprised how far a lit cigarette or flame can be seen at night. A sniper has only to sight in on the glow for a perfect headshot.
John tried it.
My man,
Junior said, complimenting him after the demonstration.
You'll get better with practice.
Junior looked up at his watch and said,
we'll take turns at watch tonight and split it up every 2 hours. This way, we can both get some sleep during the night. You can have the first shift. Just wake me up in a couple hours. You have any questions?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. Don't fuck it up now.
Junior lay on the air mattress and covered himself with the poncho liner. It was beginning to get chilly in the bunker, so John covered his back and shoulders with his own poncho liner and then moved upstairs to the top of the bunker. Sitting with his feet dangling from the roof of the bunker, he quietly looked out into the wire. It was dark enough for the shadows to begin playing tricks on his eyes. He was nervous and jumpy. As the shadows continued to move, John slowly lifted the starlight scope to his eyes, hoping not to make any sudden movements that would result in a volley of bullets fired in his direction. Through the scope sight, he was momentarily relieved to see that the shadows were only leaves of distant trees shaking and not VC sneaking up on him. At 9 o'clock, John retreated to the inside of the bunker. As he entered, the landline buzzed. This startled him, as he had already forgotten about the phone.
Taking a few deep breaths, he walked over to the buzzing phone and lifted the handset to his ear.
Hello?
He said meekly.
Number 5, this is the CP. Give me a sit rep,
ordered the voice on the other end of the line.
This is number 5. All clear,
John reported.
Roger, out.
He replaced the handset onto the cradle, then returned to continue his vigil in the darkness. At 10 o'clock, he woke Junior and took his place on the air mattress.
Everything go okay?
Junior asked.
Except for that damn phone scaring the shit out of me, it wasn't too bad.
Junior smiled and moved to the front of the bunker.
Get some rest, and I'll wake you at midnight for your next shift.
A half hour passed, and John had just dozed off when the sound of a large explosion caused him to jump from the air mattress and move aimlessly through the bunker.
What's happening?
He hollered in a panic.
Are we getting hit?
Junior reached out and grabbed John by the shoulder.
Damn, John, settle down. We're not being attacked.
John stopped, undecided about what to do next.
Sit your white ass down and catch your breath,
Junior ordered.
You just scared the fuck out of me by jumping up like that.
I didn't mean to.
I know you didn't, but you sure got a lot to get used to before you go out into the bush.
John tried to catch his breath and heard voices from the center of the compound.
Adjust right, 1-5 degrees, charge 4, 6 rounds, hotel echo, fire.
He suddenly realized that the destructive rounds were firing outward and were not enemy rounds coming at them.
Man, those big guns are really loud this close up. Why are they firing anyway? The CP said that Charlie Company spotted flashlights about 500 meters from their location. They've asked to fire several 105-millimeter rounds around the area and will send out a patrol in the morning to investigate.
A deep and distant crump, crump, crump noise interrupted Junior's train of thought when the artillery rounds landed several miles away. A buzzing sound also came from the same direction, almost like a circular saw cutting across a wood board.
What's that new sound?
John asked.
It's probably a Cobra gunship. We'll know for sure in a minute. Now, how in the hell can you tell that from this distance, especially in the dark? You're a question machine. Just keep facing in the direction that you heard the shells hit. If you're lucky, look there, see it?
Junior asked, pointing to a long, thin red line in the sky. It extended from somewhere in the air to the ground.
Get some, Charlie Company!
Junior cheered. After a second, the end of the red line raced to the ground, and the sky went dark again. These lightning strikes continued for a few moments and then stopped for good. Every fifth round on a belt of ammunition was a tracer round, chemically treated to leave a gas vapor trail. When fired from the mini guns of the Cobra, the rate of fire was so intense, those rounds appeared as a solid line to the target.
Wow, that looks pretty,
John volunteered.
It is to us, but you can bet your ass VC don't think so. They say that when a Cobra flies over a football field firing that minigun, you find bullets in every square foot of that field.
Damn, was all John could say. After the show, things quieted down, and John returned to the air mattress, wide awake. The rest of the night continued without incident, and he became accustomed to some of the nighttime sounds of war, making it easier for him to relax. The next morning at 6 o'clock, they were relieved from guard duty. Both decided against breakfast, and instead headed straight to the hooch to get some sleep. When John awoke at 11, Junior was already gone, so he headed toward the mess tent to get a bite of lunch. He did not have much time to spare, as the Rhodes security team was leaving at noon. In the mess tent, John was surprised to see Bill standing behind a serving table, dishing out mashed potatoes from a green insulated container.
Hey, Bill, got stuck with KP, huh?
He read.
Yeah, but it ain't bad. It's just like slopping the hogs back home. All I got to do is pass out this food. The cooks do all the pot and pan washing.
That doesn't sound all that bad. Were you able to sleep last night with all that racket going on?
I slept for shit, John, and lost count of how many times I bounced into the air from a cot. You should have seen me. I was on bunker guard last night with that black guy, Junior. Talk about jumpy. He was a real bitch for me.
What are you doing this afternoon? Bill asked. I have to go out on road security detail in 45 minutes. I understand we'll be back by 7, so maybe we can get together then, okay?
That sounds good. Now, don't do anything stupid while you're out there, Pola. I'll look for you later.
The road security team positioned itself on the top of a small knoll, 3 miles from the nearest village.
Using binoculars, the six men took turns at watching the road and the surrounding rice paddies. The view was so unobstructed, they could see for 5 miles in any direction. Throughout the entire afternoon, at least 30 kids surrounded the soldiers at any given time. Most of them were hustlers who tried to sell them anything from soda and whiskey to women, chickens, and dope. It was like a flea market, with everybody making sales pitches. The time passed quickly. One of the soldiers, a pimple-faced, blonde-haired teenager reading a comic book, looked up and commented to the group.
"Be very glad that the kids are out here with us today."
"Well, why's that?" John asked. He dropped his book and looked John in the face.
"If they weren't around, then something would definitely happen out here. The villagers know when Charlie's around and are smart enough to not let their kids be caught in the middle of a firefight,"
he remarked before returning to his Archie comic book. The security team returned to the firebase at 19:30. It was later than expected, but the cooks held back some food for the late-arriving details. The small tent was crowded, so John took his tray of food back to his hooch. When he walked in, Junior was waiting for him.
"Come on, man, I got 25 minutes for guard duty, and we got a lot of packing to do before then,"
Junior said.
"I didn't have a chance to eat yet,"
John protested.
"That's too bad. I promised the LT that I'd help you get ready for the bush. You're going out tomorrow, and I won't have another chance before you leave."
"Oh, all right, let's get this over with,"
John whined.
"First thing we have to do is fit this aluminum frame to your back. All your possessions will be carried on your back, so you better make sure it's comfortable."
Junior removed the frame after adjusting it properly and then attached an empty ammo can to the bottom of the frame.
"Put all your important shit in here, like your wallet, camera, radio, writing paper, anything else that you want to keep dry and uncrushed."
Once filled and with the waterproof lid clamped into place, Junior attached John's rucksack to the top of the frame, allowing the bottom to rest on top of the ammo can.
"John, the main thing to remember is to keep this thing balanced. Everything will have its own place. You have to get rid of this air mattress,"
Junior said, tossing it to the side.
"It squeaks and makes too much noise in the bush."
"Well, what will I have to sleep on?"
"Your poncho and the ground, just like everybody else."
"Oh, that blows."
"Hey, man, this isn't a Boy Scout outing,"
Junior scolded.
"Now go through this case of sea rations and pick out your meals you want to eat for the next 3 days. But just take enough to get by. Don't take any breakfast meals. It'll cut down on the weight. All you really need in the morning is coffee or cocoa, and they don't weigh shit."
John separated the meals and placed them on the bottom of the ruck. Next, they rolled up the poncho liner and stuffed it inside, covering the cans of food. There was barely enough room left to fit 2 more claymore mines, wires, and clackers into the pack. John pulled the flap over the bulging rug and then secured it tightly, utilizing the pouches on the rear and sides of the rucksack, stuffing them full of packets of cocoa powder, sugar, coffee, plastic utensils, heat tabs, and cigarettes. They added 4 1-quart canteens next, placing 2 on each side of the ruck for proper balance, and then tied 4 smoke grenades and trip flares to the straps on the back of the ruck. The handles of 6 grenades fit nicely into the metal rings on the front of the web harness for easy access. The last thing they did was roll up the vinyl poncho and tie it to the underside of the ammo can with 2 shoelaces.
"Well, it's packed. Now try it out,"
Junior suggested. John put on his web harness, looped the bandolier of ammunition around his neck, and then tried to pick up his rucksack. Surprised, he was unable to lift it beyond his knees.
"God damn!"
he exclaimed, struggling with the pack while trying to swing it onto his back. Junior laughed.
"My man, there's a trick to it,"
he said, and reached to stop John so he wouldn't hurt himself.
"Put it back on the ground and sit down with your back against the frame."
John dropped the pack and sat on the hard-packed ground. He slid backwards across the dirt, stopping when his back touched the frame.
"Place your arms through the straps and pull yourself up by grabbing hold of something. If you can't locate anything, then turn over on your knees and try to get up that way."
John secured the frame to his back and managed to pull himself up, taking hold of a support beam next to him. Once on his feet, he weaved from side to side and almost toppled over before Junior reached out and grabbed him.
"It'll take some time to get the feel of it. Try walking around some more,"
Junior encouraged. The longer he stayed on his feet, the easier it appeared. After a couple of minutes, John was certain he could manage without falling flat on his face. He flashed a wide grin to Junior.
"How's it feel?"
"Oh, not bad now. These 60 pounds don't really seem all that heavy once you get used to it."
Get used to it.
Junior laughed loudly.
Bro, listen up. I've been humping a ruck for 4 months, and I still ain't used to it.
Wait until you start humping that thing out in the bush. You'll swear to God it weighs 300 pounds. It won't be long before you cut down to one meal a day and look for other ways to make that load lighter.
Junior looked at John with admiration for the way he tried to conceal his strain under the heavy load.
Okay, now put the ruck down. Later you can practice more. I only have a couple of minutes left to finish up.
John dropped the ruck to the ground and looked at Junior in disbelief.
I thought we were done.
We're done with the ruck, but now we have to get you ready. Take off your shorts, socks, and belt, and get rid of them,
Junior ordered.
Get rid of them?
John asked.
Are you joking?
No joke, my man. Believe me when I tell you that you do not need them in the bush. With all that humping and sweating out there, you'll rub your balls raw if you wear drawers.
And not wearing a belt will prevent the ticks and leeches from getting under your belt line and burning into your skin. Socks will only give you problems in the bush. Without them, your feet will stay drier, and you won't have as many blisters. You can either take my word and do it now, or you can learn it the hard way.
John was not interested in arguing with Junior, so he started removing the items as Junior had suggested. When finished, he reached for his tray of now-cold food.
Not yet, brother,
Junior cautioned.
We still have one last item remaining on the checklist. Now, what else could be left? Take your shoelaces halfway out of your boots.
Without questioning him any further, John untied his first boot and looked up to Junior with a look of uncertainty.
Why am I doing this? I'm not interested in braiding my shoelaces.
The silver chain around my neck is all the jewelry I need,
he stated sarcastically.
Would you just knock off the shit and do what I tell you? I'm already late for guard duty,
Junior shot back.
Okay, Junior, now what?
He asked when both boots were half-laced.
Take the dog tags from the chains around your neck and attach one to each shoelace. Then retie your boots.
Won't they get all muddy on my boots?
Oh, they'll get muddy all right. At least they won't rattle as they do now hanging from your neck. You'll find out how important noise discipline is in the bush.
John sat back and stared at Junior after tying both boots.
I'm afraid to ask, but are we finally through?
Yeah, man, go ahead and eat your chow. Try and get some practice with that ruck tonight. It'll make it easy on you tomorrow.
Sorry I was so impatient, Junior. All bullshit aside, I really do appreciate all your help. I couldn't have done it by myself.
Oh, that's okay. What a brother's for, anyway. Someday you'll be able to help out at Cherry, and he'll be grateful and thank you for your help and understanding. Like I told you yesterday, we have to take care of each other.
Junior gathered his gear for guard duty and was about to rush out of the door when John intercepted him.
Junior,
he called, placing his hand on the black man's shoulder.
I'm starting to get a little uptight. Will it be really bad out there?
Junior stopped cold.
No sweat, you'll do just fine. Respect and listen to the old-timers who have been here for a while and do exactly what they tell you. Who knows, it might be weeks before you have your first firefight, and then again, it may be tomorrow. Just don't go out there thinking you're John Wayne, because it will get you killed. Get some rest tonight. Don't worry about it. I gotta go. I'll see you in the morning before you leave.
Junior turned with his gear in hand and quickly dashed out through the doorway. In the morning, everyone struggled with their gear and stumbled out of the main gate toward the helipad. When the Cherries arrived, every one of them immediately fell to the ground, exhausted. Alpha Company was not in a position yet to accept the resupply, so the group had to sit in the hot sun and wait for over an hour. The engine started, thus signaling an end to the uncomfortable wait. The Cherries awkwardly got to their feet and quickly boarded the choppers to wait once again. John and Bill found themselves sitting in positions identical to those of their first helicopter flight. A look of dread and despair came over them.
Maybe our rucksacks weigh enough to hold us in. Let's loop arms anyway. It seemed to work fine the first time. Okay, at least we know what to expect this time.
When looking toward the gate, John could see Junior running through the whirlwind toward his chopper.
You thought you'd leave without me saying goodbye?
He yelled over the noise of the engines. John could only shake his hand and try to force a smile.
Good luck, Polak. I'll see you soon.
It was the first time that Junior ever called John by his nickname. John knew at that moment that not only was Junior his mentor, he also had become his buddy. The door gunner motioned for Junior to back away. The RPM increased wildly, and the chopper began to rise. In an instant, Junior was gone.